Well, here we are at the end of August, which means we are at the end of summer. Where did it go? I hope you had a great summer. I hope that you got a lot of good reading in this summer on your vacation and whatnot. And I hope part of that reading list was my book, Precipice, The Left's Campaign to Destroy America. So if you haven't ordered it yet or you haven't read it yet, please do so. I think you'll enjoy it. And all the proceeds go to a great cause, which is the CNX Foundation, a mentorship academy. So here we are at the far middle with episode 67. And the dedication at the end of August to number 67 is going to go to the year 1967, because 1967 brought us three sports accomplishments that were of significant note. We'll start with the first one, which was first. And what I mean by that, as in the first Super Bowl that was held in January of 1967. Of course, the Packers, coached by a guy named Lombardi, beat the Chiefs, coached by a guy named Stram. Both of those are individuals who are in the Hall of Fame. They played the game in the LA Coliseum, and I'd say it's safe to say that the game has grown a bit since that first Super Bowl back in 1967. But there were two other epic performances in 1967 that were bigger and more of note than even the first Super Bowl. And these two events are what we're going to jointly dedicate episode 67 with respect to. So the first one comes from the world of NASCAR. It's a sport I know very little about. I admit that going in. But even I, a person who knows very little about NASCAR, even I heard of a guy named Richard Petty. So Petty set a lot of records in NASCAR, which is why even a NASCAR novice like myself knows who he is. But two of his records will almost certainly never be broken, and both were set in the 1967 NASCAR season. So Petty won an astonishing 27 races, and that was of a 48 total run of races for the season, or 56% of the races in that NASCAR season. And even more astonishing, he won 10 in a row. Now, today, there are less races per season in NASCAR, but even when you adjust for the modern season, there's very little chance these two epic records are going to be broken, particularly the 10 in a row wins. And by the way, the next best in a row record is half of Petty's at 10, and it sits at 5. And Petty, he co-owns that one, number 5, 5 wins in a row at number 2 as well. And even if you prorate the new shorter seasons to see who can hit a 56% win rate, I don't think it's going to happen. I don't think you're going to see that. Now, the second epic performance in 1967 for our co-dedication, it's a sport that I know a little more about than NASCAR. That's pro basketball. 1967 saw the championship won by what I consider to be the best team in NBA history for a single season. And that's the Philadelphia 76ers of 1966-1967. They were stacked, and their nicknames of the players on that team made them even better. They had some of the best nicknames collectively of any team you'll ever find in sports. Now, of course, that Sixers team, it all started with the center, one of the five greatest ever in NBA history. That, of course, is Wilt, the Big Dipper Chamberlain. And we've covered him a number of times in prior Far Middle episodes with our dedications. But that season, he averaged 24 points per game and 24 rebounds per game, which is unreal. Another Hall of Famer was on that team alongside the Big Dipper. That was Hal Greer. He averaged close to what Wilt was putting up, 22 points per game. And then you also had Chet the Jet Walker, another Hall of Famer. Great player in the paint. That was his area of expertise where he set up shop. And then you had yet another Hall of Famer on that team, Billy the Kangaroo Kid Cunningham. Notice a trend here with all the Hall of Famers on this team, by the way. Great TV announcer, too. I always enjoyed Billy Cunningham on TV broadcasts when I was growing up watching basketball after he had retired. And then there was Luke Luscious Jackson. He was a great rebounder and defender, basically the intimidator of the team along with Chamberlain. And then you had Wally Wonder Jones. He was sort of a streaky shooter and scorer when he got hot. Yeah, I love the Celtics dynasty teams with Russell and Havlicek and then Larry Bird. I'm more familiar with the Bird teams when I was growing up. And I love the Lakers of the 80s and I love the Bulls with Jordan of the 90s. But the 1966-1967 Philadelphia 76ers, that was the best single season team in the history of the NBA, in my humble opinion. So episode 67 co-dedicated to two greatest evers seasons, right, in 1967, Richard Petty in NASCAR and the 76ers in the NBA. Magical seasons, the likes of which come once in a blue moon. Let's take that blue moon concept to get rolling with connecting dots on this episode of The Far Middle. Because when it comes to asset valuations, and let's talk here specifically about equity assets in the United States, stocks, we have an inflated valuation level that we see only once in a blue moon. And there are two new perspectives that I'd like to lay out there for you that illustrate the inflated level of U.S. equities or U.S. stocks. And the first one is in the context of how U.S. equities rank in valuation relative to equities from other countries across the globe. So it sort of puts the United States and its stock market in perspective to those of other nations and their stock markets or their individual stocks. And there are a lot of metrics to use to measure relative valuation and priciness. And none of them are individually perfect, and all of them have their own degrees of flaw. But one of the better ones is the ratio of forward price to earnings ratio to a 10-year prior average of price to earnings ratio. So if you recall from prior Far Middles, the price to earnings ratio, it's a way to measure the priciness of stocks. The higher the price to earnings ratio, the more expensive the stock is, and the lower the price to earning ratio, the cheaper the stock is relative to what it's expected to generate in earnings for an individual share or shareholder. And you can measure PE ratios over time to see how current price to earnings levels compare to the past PE ratios, which this ratio does by comparing the forward expected price to earnings ratio for the next year to the average PE over the past 10 years. So it sort of gives you next year's expectations in the context of historical. So using this ratio and then running it for all the major national equity markets around the globe, it comes out and shows that the United States S&P 500 stock index is pricey and it's expensive relative to other markets in the world. So the S&P has this forward PE to last 10-year average PE of just over 1. That ratio works out to just over a 1.0. And there are a few national stock indexes and indices that are more expensive and pricier. You see them in New Zealand, India, and the Netherlands. But most countries, the vast majority of countries, have cheaper and in some instances much cheaper stock valuations. I'll give you some examples. Brazil and Hungary, those ratios for those nations on their stock indexes and indices are half of what they are in the United States. So in other words, the United States is twice as pricey on average for our S&P 500 stock index versus those in Brazil and Hungary. Italy and Poland are less than 2/3 of the U.S. S&P relative expensiveness, and the U.K., is less than 3/4 of the U.S. S&P priciness. So yes, there is definitely a premium when it comes to stock market valuations in the United States when compared to the rest of the world, or at least most of the rest of the world. And then there's also another metric to consider when it comes to U.S. equity valuations currently versus history or perspective to other metrics. And that is how that price to earnings ratio today compares to what it has been under different inflation levels over our history. Because, of course, right, inflation is definitely impacting, will always impact stock market valuations. So right now, our CPI, our Consumer Price Index, is running around 9% annually, which is white hot. And when inflation is in that 9-ish percentage zone, the S&P 500 index in the United States historically has hovered around a price to earnings ratio of about 11 times. Now, using trailing 12 months of earnings, what's the S&P price to earnings ratio today? 20 times. That's almost double what it historically has averaged when you have inflation hovering around 9%, which is where we're at today. So we've got yet a few more additional strong indicators or metrics that the stock market is very expensive and pricey. And we've talked about this a couple of times in prior episodes of The Far Middle. Markets are very interesting, but they affect all of us from 401ks to pensions to net worth, so they matter. And constant listeners, they ask me often when I run into them or we're talking about the market, yeah, we heard that you've got these considerations or concerns, and that's been really interesting, but are you in the market based on what you're seeing and concerned about? And that's a good question. And the answer is, yeah, I'm in the market, at least to a certain extent. Enough of an extent, let's say, where I hope I am wrong on the concern that I've got of a stock market bubble and its priciness. Because these days, you almost have to be at least partially in the stock market. So, you know, I'm wading in there with the rest of you, truth be known, but I fear what's lurking below and what the future holds not just for myself, but for all of us. And this brings me to the next topic, something I've been wanting to talk about for a while on The Far Middle. We got a chance here on episode 67. Let's take that concept of sports where we kick things off and connect it to asset bubbles, like we just spoke about with the S&P 500 and stocks. How about another asset and potentially an asset bubble, this one in professional sports teams' valuations? So what's driving the price tags of these sports teams, these pro franchises, into the stratosphere? Well, certainly, you know, things like Fed monetary policy since 2008, that's inflated all asset classes, including the value of sports franchises. And again, we discuss that regularly on The Far Middle. When money's free and returns elsewhere are limited due to low interest rates and lofty valuations, yeah, it's going to pump up the demand for sports teams as an asset class, just like art and wine and coins and sports cards and high-end real estate. But then there's the large money pools. And here I'm talking about it could be private equity or hedge fund chieftains, sovereign royals chasing these trophy-type assets in the sports world. And as stock valuations of public corporations get bloated into the upper percentiles, right, they use their stock, the corporations did, as a currency to acquire sports teams. Particularly media companies had been doing that. But now we've got something new that is driving the valuations of sports franchises even higher. That is what I'll call the commoditization of small or non-controlling or minority percentages of ownership interest in sports teams through private equity firms. And it's a relatively new development. I can tell you it's growing rapidly, and it looks to be the new normal when it comes to the ownership of sports teams and how they're valued. So private equity, it's always, I think, been interested in something like sports ownership as an asset class. But what was missing for years was each league in the professional sports world being comfortable with the new capital pool of private equity taking positions in their teams. So there wasn't necessarily a willing seller that was ready, willing, and able or excited about bringing in private equity as a partner. And the concern, I'm guessing, was that a new class of ownership like private equity that would be more volatile and might change over more quickly, create a little more of a churn versus stability in your ownership. Now, that comfort of the leagues took some time to develop, but perhaps the riches were too much to resist in the end, because now you've got all these leagues across the United States, the NBA, the NHL, Major League Baseball, MLS, they have or are ready and willing to take on private equity owners in minority non-controlling capacities. And by the way, so does the English Premier League with soccer. And I think the NFL, I didn't mention the NFL on that list because they're not there yet, but I think they may soon follow. Some argue, of course, that the NFL does not need to. It's got more money than it knows what to do with already. Yeah, right. This is the NFL that we're talking about. There is never going to be any such thing as enough money when it comes to the NFL. Now, in 2021, private equity firms, they doled out $51 billion on sports deals worldwide, and $3 billion of that went into buying non-controlling stakes in teams. So a private equity firm recently raised $3 billion for a sports ownership fund. It's the largest first-time capital raise for that type of an investment vehicle. The Golden State Warriors, they're an example in the NBA of a well-known team that has private equity, minority, or non-controlling owners. And there are others with that type of ownership as well. The Boston Red Sox, my Pittsburgh Penguins here in Pittsburgh, the Dodgers in baseball, to name a few. And that list is sure to grow as time marches on. And just to be clear to those constant listeners maybe who aren't familiar with the term I use of non-controlling ownership in sports teams, you know, most teams have a general partner or a group who makes all the big decisions, who to sign, you know, which players to sign, who to let go, whether to move to a different city, whether to sell the team, whether you pay a distribution to owners, and so on. That's the controlling owner or the partner. Then the rest of the ownership, to get to the 100% of ownership, they are those non-controlling owners who typically own small minority ownership pieces, say less than 30%, sometimes only a percent or two of an interest in a team. And you own that portion of the team, but you are more or less a passive investor. You're going to be subject to the decisions of the controlling or general partner. So you're along for the ride to a large extent. And that's by design. You know that going in when you're making your investment. So the private equity firm is now working with pro sports teams and franchises to buy into those non-controlling stakes in each team. And of course, the private equity firm is doing so to put money to work because it expects a return. And if you read some of the materials these private equity funds issue that are active in this space, you quickly deduce they are looking for entry points on their investment into teams, you know, that have a couple of characteristics. They've got good profitability. They offer up some nice growth prospects to their base business plan, and that also have a chance of a step change or a one-time valuation proposition in a form of a change in control. And change in control, that's a fancy finance and legal term that means you're basically hoping to buy into an ownership stake of a team where the controlling partner is going to decide to sell the team at a massive profit. Yes, as an investor, the private equity firm is buying into a team it hopes will be sold. And whether the team stays in their city or moves as part of the sale, you know, I'm sure the private equity investor or owner could not care less. It's all about the money. Emotions don't matter. And this gets really interesting as you follow through and down the investment chain. So at the top, you've got the team. And the team, as I said, it's got one of its owners. This is a controlling owner or partner who makes, as I said, all the big decisions. But then you've got the non-controlling owners that own a percentage of the team. But as I said, they're more or less passive investors. And that's where the private equity firm is now entering the fray. And the private equity firm, this is where it gets even doubly interesting. They typically have a structure similar to the pro sports team. They've got a controlling partner within the private equity firm who makes all the decisions and manages the fund. And then the non-controlling limited partner investors who buy into the private equity fund as mostly passive owners. So when you map this out for a team's ownership that has private equity, non-controlling investors, you've got the controlling team owners at the top. Then you've got a private equity firm as a non-controlling owner. Then within that private equity piece, you have a general partner controlling owner along with limited partner non-controlling investors in the fund, private equity fund itself. It's complex, but I think it's really interesting because let's say I have a pension that invests into a private equity fund, or I'm an investor who directly invests into one of these private equity funds. What I'm doing when that fund goes after a non-controlling ownership piece of a sports team is I'm feeling like I own part of the pro sports team, which is cool, but the reality is that I've effectively zero say-so or impact on decisions of that team because the PE fund, it's got a managing partner that manages its decisions for me. And then the sports team trumps that with yet another controlling partner or owner on top of it. So at least when you buy a share of stock, you can vote your share pro rata. So if you own a share of Apple, you get a say-so at the annual meeting, even though it's de minimis in the end. But with investing in a private equity firm who then invests in a pro sports team, you have absolute zero input. But I bet more than a few investors will line up to invest and bet on these private equity sports team focused funds. And investing like other walks, right? Marketing and gloss, they can overshadow quite a bit when it comes to the important details. All right. So that, again, was interesting. I've been wanting to get to that for a while. I hope you enjoyed that. And that also brings me to the next connection. So private equity, right, they can put money to work in many places and in a lot of different markets. So why sports teams? What's the allure? Well, as I discussed a minute ago, it's simple. It's the allure of stellar returns, aka greed. So this is maybe where we cue the Gordon Gekko from Wall Street. Greed, for lack of a better word, is good, at least when it comes to, I guess, investing options and opportunities with private equity firms. And since 2002, the major sports leagues in the United States, I was surprised to see this, they performed better than the S&P 500, and sometimes by a huge margin, like they just blew the S&P 500 away. So in the last 20 years, the NBA is up on average over 1,000% in valuation or return. Major League Baseball is up almost 700%, NFL almost 600%, NHL is up almost 500%. The S&P 500 is up around 460%. So again, it's lagging all of those four major leagues that I just mentioned. And valuations have held steady or risen since the start of pandemic 2 years ago, even as profits of these sports teams have fallen. So perhaps it's a sign of a classic asset bubble. Maybe you're asking that question. And the answer is perhaps, but of course, nobody knows for sure. Time will tell, and we'll all know and see, well, maybe once again, that past performance, it's not necessarily a guarantee for future performance. But those in the sports ownership class the past two decades, they just made an absolute killing, at least on paper. Ted Leonsis, he owns the Washington Capitals in the NHL. I read something he said I thought was really interesting that I wanted to share with you. He said, quote, "Everyone thought I was crazy for buying the Capitals for $85 million 20 years ago when the team was losing $20 million a year. Now it's worth $1.5 billion, end quote. Not bad, Ted, not bad. And I guess Ovechkin was worth every dollar you paid him. Market bubbles, sports, you know, it sort of brings us to another dot to connect. Another 1967 sports achievement. That was a heck of a year for sports. Besides the first Super Bowl and Richard Petty and the 76ers, was a state university in the nice LA area known as Westwood. This is UCLA I'm talking about. And an unassuming gentleman known as Coach John Wooden. They won their first of seven NCAA basketball titles in a row. And speaking of LA and sports, I want to share some thoughts on why Southern California sports teams never seem to draw huge fans in attendance, especially considering the massive population that you've got there in the LA Basin. I mean, every game of every team in every sport should be sellouts and intensely watched by the residents of Southern California, but that isn't the case typically, and I always wondered why. Like, why is that not the case? And the possible answer dawned on me the other week when I was out in the Los Angeles area. Had some business to conduct and spent an extra day to visit family out there. And I found myself in Huntington Beach in Orange County, walking in the evening along the beach that sort of parallels the Pacific Coast Highway. And there were a lot of people on the beach that Saturday night, not hundreds at Huntington Beach, but thousands. And I was people watching as we walked. You couldn't help but do it. So you had families, extended families, bunches of friends all getting together, a very, you know, sort of diverse, multicultural crowd, sort of a really like neat scene to see. And these individuals and these groups, they came well prepared. I mean, they took a day at the beach as a serious endeavor. You had well-constructed fire pits, you had games, you had tables, tents. I saw couches and music. And when it came to food, again, based on what I was able to see, a feast of food everywhere you looked. And this was serious food. I'm not talking like snacks, like pretzels or chips. It was pretty damn impressive for a guy from Western Pennsylvania to see that, that going on at the beach. And that is when it dawned on me as to why pro sports and major college sports teams don't get the attendance and following you expect in Southern California. Watching other people play sports, it just can't compete with Southern California weather, the beach, and the ocean. So people around Los Angeles, they want to spend time with friends and family just like we do in the north and in the east. But they figured out you don't need to drive to a congested stadium and get extorted with respect to prices to do so and have fun. You just go to the beach for free and you enjoy one of the best settings on earth. It's a weekend day at the beaches, and the Southern California version has become basically their version of tailgating in the Northeast and the Midwest. So life isn't fair, constant listeners. In Pittsburgh, we've got months of dreary and cold, nothing to do. Dark when you wake up and dark when you come home from work in the winter. So we gather with friends and family on the frozen concrete, the stadium lots to suffer through the weather. Then we go into the stadium to suffer some more. And then we head back to the cars with no feeling in any sort of extremity of our body. Our fellow Americans in Southern California, they got it so much better. Heck, the beach and weather there, it draws people despite the insanity of California policies and cost of living and traffic and all kinds of other issues. It sure as heck, I think, a day at the beach in Southern California can sure as heck overcome the Angels or the Anaheim Ducks or the Clippers or the Chargers. I've seen the future of tailgating, ladies and gentlemen, and it's called the beaches in Orange County. Now, moving on to the next topic, speaking of Southern California and beaches, it makes me think of surfing, something I've never done and probably can't do. And one of the more famous surfing towns in Orange County down in California is Dana Point, just south of Laguna Beach. And in Dana Point, there was, and still actually is, a family deli that's got some great food. And that deli had the back half of it at one time serving as a used bookstore. So I went in there to eat a few years ago and came out with five books instead. Now, the deli is still there, as I said, but it no longer sells books, I'm sorry to report. And this brought me to the next topic, because a lot of you from time to time, especially after we talk in an episode about literature or authors, or I post something on nicktheolius.com with respect to those, you ask me what my favorite bookstores are. Well, let me list them for you so that you can write these down or make note of them when you're visiting these different locales. So I'll start with Pittsburgh, of course. And for me, I love half-price books. Truth, in the past 20 years or however long Half Price Books have been there, I don't think I've ever walked out of that store without a book, without at least one book. So I'm a big follower of Half Price Books. Now, in San Francisco, if you're in San Francisco, you have to check out, of course, the legendary City Lights Booksellers. That's where the Beat Generation Ground Zero sits, and it's also close to some great Italian restaurants in North Beach. But my favorite bookstore in San Francisco is Green Apple Books. There are lots and lots of used books in Esser. I love used bookstores. You'll see that as a theme. How about Savannah, Georgia? What a great walking town. It's got just all kinds of public squares and old architecture to look at. I was there a few months ago. I got lost in a place called the Book Lady Bookstore. So check that place out, the Book Lady Bookstore in Savannah, Georgia. Used books, got some rare books as well. You will not walk out without something, I promise you that. If you're in our nation's capital, so if you're down in D.C., Second Story Books. It's near DuPont Circle. They've got used books. They've got leather-bound books. They've got rare books. I'll warn you, this is a serious store for the serious book lover. So the warning goes with sort of an asterisk. You got to leave enough time to peruse through this one. You're not going to want to rush through it. So if you've got a tight schedule or tight plans, they may be delayed appreciably when you get in there and see what it's got to offer. And last but not least, there is a pair of great bookstores in Asheville, North Carolina. In fact, they're very close to one another. They're basically right across the street from one another. One is Battery Park Book Exchange. It's two stories in a historic arcade building in downtown Asheville. You got a coffee bar in this place. You got a wine bar in this place. It's pretty awesome. Just shelves and shelves of used and classic books. And the other one is very close by. It's Downtown Books and News. It's not quite as big as Battery Park, but it's got some great older and rarer books. It's total fun to be had in either while you're in Asheville, which, by the way, is the hometown of the great author Thomas Wolfe. I'm going to write a piece on Thomas Wolfe here in the upcoming weeks or months, so stay tuned for that. I think you'll enjoy it. Okay, time to bring home episode 67. And on the subject of books and great authors that we're talking about, I need to talk about the passing a few weeks ago of the great David McCullough. Pittsburgh native, two-time Pulitzer Prize winner, recipient of the Presidential Medal of Freedom. He accomplished it all in his field. He started out working, I didn't know this until I was reading up on him a few weeks ago, started out his career working at Sports Illustrated, of all places, I think as an intern. The biographies he wrote are amazing. Of course, my two favorite are John Adams and Truman. The historical topics he covered are great. The Johnstown Flood, it was one of his first books, I believe, maybe his first book. And he also wrote a great book on the Panama Canal that you should give a read if you get a chance. And then 1776, great account of the story of the birth of our nation. Now, the other thing I loved about McCullough, like who didn't enjoy his narration on Ken Burns' docuseries on the Civil War? And by the way, I confuse and others often confuse David McCullough's voice when he narrates with John Chancellor's because they sort of sound similar. They both got great, great voices for narration. McCullough, he did the Civil War documentary of Ken Burns, while Chancellor was the one who narrated the baseball documentary for Ken Burns. Both of them were awesome documentaries. Now, I had a chance to attend a lecture given by McCullough years ago in Pittsburgh. I was an avid reader of his works ever since. I still have a few of his books to get to with his passing, and I suppose that's a small positive within a great loss of an American treasure, an American icon. So David McCullough, he may be gone, but he is far from forgotten. Till next week, constant listeners, go out there and seize the day.